Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Support. And I'm here with my two partners in crime, Matt Kachansky, retired Special Agent in Charge from the OIG, and the retired Northeast UPIC Director. And he is now on career number three as the Payment Integrity Director here at Advise, overseeing our team of investigators, analysts, and auditors on our SIU team. And his right-hand guy, Wade McFall, is the retired Assistant Special Agent in Charge from OIG's LA field office and a manager on our SIU team. So today and for the next few weeks, we're going to do some breakdowns of some of the press releases that are out there because we're continuing to see some really unbelievably large numbers. The one we want to talk about today involves a company named Power Mobility RX, $1 billion. I have to do that with the B, Dr. Evil, $1 billion fraud for telemedicine, telefraud in the DME space. This is on the heels of a number of other really large telemedicine-related fraud cases, right? We've got Operation Brace Yourself in 2019, Operation Double Helix, I believe that was 2022. The $2 billion catheter case from last year. I mean, it just keeps happening. It's just insane. The dollar amounts are huge, and so obviously crime does pay. Because otherwise people wouldn't do it. So this one is an interesting one in the sense that, you know, for $1 billion, it was really a technology-based fraud scheme, which was a little bit unique because a lot of the other ones have been a little bit more human-centric. But this one, at the end of the day, again, the circus is the same. It's just the clowns that rotate. It's telemedicine fraud, no verifiable relationship between the patient and the provider, false certifications that the patient was examined by the provider, and then the provision of DME and things of that sort, collusion between the providers, being paid a kickback by the mobility company, Power Mobility. And by the way, that's just a misnomer. They weren't a mobility company as in like wheelchairs, walkers. It was just the name of their company. And all of the things associated with that, the marketers, the sales reps, probably some pretty strong identity theft issues from the deep web, things of that sort. And it's going to continue to happen until either identity theft is stopped and the ability to steal this information goes away. Social engineering tools don't work anymore. Or a combination of those things. Along with maybe some changes in payer policies regarding timeliness of claims. And we've talked about this ad nauseum about how, at least in the CMS space, providers have 12 months to submit a claim. And so therefore, it's very challenging to be able to identify an E&M showing that a patient was examined virtually or otherwise. All the way through to the provision. So, you know, Wade, the thing that sticks out is from an investigative perspective, as good as Wade McFall is, there's only one Wade McFall. And when you have a case involving $1 billion, there's likely going to be a lot of providers, a lot of marketers, a lot of individual patients having their identity stolen, and the tentacles that are out there. And, you know, really, when I see a case that's this large, the very first thing I'm thinking is, what resources do I need to bring within my team? How do I manage this? How do I deal with all of these things? From the SIU perspective, it's not like you just say, well, I'm going to refer this to law enforcement. You have to do a workup. You have to vet it. You have to do some investigative work. But the tentacles become the biggest challenge, right? And keeping track of all of these moving parts and bringing in leadership early to know, hey, I think I've stumbled on a boulder. I'm stubbing my toe right now on a rock, but I think there's a boulder behind it.
Right, and as we were discussing before too, so the press release really talks about the DME company owner being convicted. And as you mentioned, referring to him as tentacles, there's gotta be a huge cast of characters involved with this. And in the sense that you typically want to work a case up the ladder or up the chain. You don't want to just charge the street cappers or marketers. You want to get to the people behind the schemes, the ones that are devising the complex, schemes. So in that sense, they got to the top guy and convicted him, which is great. Kudos to that. But I think what we'll see in the coming weeks or months or maybe even years is, you know, they'll be convicting more than just the leader. Specifically, it's important that they convict people like the physicians who are receiving kickbacks and signing certificates of medical necessity and things of that nature. So it's just the start of the press releases, I think, and the case will be ongoing. As you mentioned, too, like a $1 million case, you could probably keep a whole region of FBI agents and OIG agents busy following up on all the dozens, if not hundreds, of other potential targets. But in, as you said, too, in the SIU world, when you get a referral like this, you don't know it's going to be a $1 billion case. So you have to do your typical, you know, look for the red flags. In this case, it's people getting DME, where if you look at the claims data, you're probably going to see members or beneficiaries who are getting DME from a physician that they don't have a previous relationship for. We talked about that before. That's a huge red flag. We look at the differences in, you know, where the member is as opposed to where the physician's office is. Why would somebody travel, you know, 2 or 3, 4 hours to go to a physician that's that far away when you have somebody closer to you? So a case like this, as huge as this is for an SIU, you start off with the basics that you're going to do on almost any case. You look for those red flags, you run down those leads, you talk to members and just get the narrative on how this claim came to be. It's like if they've never been to the physician before and they never went after, that's a red flag. A lot of times these are going to involve medical identity theft issues as well, where the patients went to some clinic and then their Medicare, their Medicaid number is out there on lists, patient lists and things of that nature. So just doing basic interviews, you might find that this patient doesn't even know about this claim, didn't get the equipment, they never got the wheelchair, they didn't get the brace or whatever. So although, kind of going back to the beginning, although this case is huge and my initial thought is a $1 billion case, that's ultimately going to end up excuse me, being a referral, because an SIU doesn't have those kind of resources. So it's going to have to go to a law enforcement agency partner. But you're not going to know that until you do those basic steps, the basic steps of doing the interviews, doing the claims data, looking for those red flags that continue to surface on, you know, it's different for every case, but we see the same red flags over and over. And that's the way a case like this ultimately started.
Right. You know, and the thing that always boggles my mind is, and I get that there's an argument about clean claims, timely payment of claims from the state rules, all that. But man, it's just frustrating for me when you see this. It's like, why isn't there an auto deny in place that when the member lives in New York, for example, and the referring provider is in California and the DME supplier is in Florida, why isn't there something built in to the algorithms of the analytics to say, hey, this is a problem? Or even in an instance where there, you know, where it's the same state, let's say, you know, these companies are getting smarter. You know, I worked on a case involving diabetic testing supplies where they were, and then it morphed into mail order topical pain creams, where they had a very complicated system where they were able to say, Makachansky lives in New York. We need a pharmacy in New York and we need a doctor in New York. And so you get it into that sense. But even then, you can get even more granular. If Makachansky lives on Long Island and the pharmacy is in the Bronx and the doctor's in Buffalo, I'm giving you three different points. Like, that should raise a flag, geolocating, geospacing, something like that. It's just like, man, you look at these billion-dollar cases and you're like, why is this even happening? Notwithstanding the fact that you have the 12 month in the CMS space, at least the 12 months to submit your claim and whatever plan time frames there are and things of that sort. But it just always begs the question of that. And, you know, Matt, it gets to this whole point of the kickbacks we're never going to necessarily know about because It's done behind closed doors and someone has to tell on themselves. But, you know, we were just talking about these instances where you go and you talk to a member and they show you, you know, 50 knee braces. You know, by the time they're done, they look like RoboCop. You know, they've got, you know, all this equipment and they have no idea where it came from and they don't call to report anything. They don't do anything. But, you know, some of these things just kind of beg for answers. No prior history with the patient. Well, that's an easy one. You know, there's no exam in the past 12 months. The patient is in a different state. You know, orthotics are a huge thing. If it's a telemedicine case, and I, you know, I kind of joke about it, but, you know, if you needed a knee brace, in what world do you think it's appropriate for a doctor to order a knee brace when it's not an in-person examination? You know, in you know, my father, God bless him, I get on FaceTime with him, and I spend 90% of the time looking at the ceiling fan because he doesn't know how to properly adjust the screen. How is he going to be able to adjust the screen to a doctor who says, okay, Eric's dad, I want you to walk back and forth and show me where your knee pain is? Like, you know, like how, these things just, it kind of begs, like, from all accounts of policy and procedure, it's just mind-boggling to me.
Dad, I'm a dinosaur. I remember when DME fraud, the big issue was the direct contact with the beneficiaries by the companies, where they had the whole warehouse of operators that were robocalling the beneficiaries, and that was outlawed. You could not direct contact a beneficiary unless they contacted you. That was the greatest gift that was ever given to the DME companies, because where they were touching hundreds of people before through these extraordinary efforts to contact them, now through one TV commercial or one mass mailing, they're hitting hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people across the country, enticing the poor beneficiaries or members to, you have back pain? Medicare covers something for you. Call this number. And all of a sudden, it's the beneficiary initiating the contact. So it gets rid of, you know, it puts the onus on the beneficiary who, you know, maybe these commercials are on at 2 o'clock in the morning. And as you said, they're having trouble keeping up with their medications. And all of a sudden they're, oh, something can relieve my pain. I'm going to call it.
Right.
And it's just an awful situation that I don't know how to fix that front end line of defense. Senior Medicare Patrol and all the enrollment folks and all the outreach people in the plans can do all the education they want. It's only going to have a minimal effect. Right. So these companies, that's why it's never going to go away.
Right. Well, and you know, one of the things that I think people tend to not understand or realize is, for example, if you're diabetic or you're having knee pain and you are computer literate as a Medicare beneficiary and you go online, it is not uncommon. You go onto a website and maybe you find, you know, we saw this a lot in the diabetic testing space, people going on and completing a survey to get a free cookbook for diabetic cooking. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is you're getting that free cookbook, but that information is being culled together and being sold, because there's fine print that says by clicking submit to get this cookbook, you're also agreeing to have your information shared for sales and marketing purposes. And what winds up happening is you get your cookbook, but your information is then going to be sold. And the next thing you know, you're getting a phone call saying, oh, you know, hey, Mr. Smith, I understand you got a cookbook. You're diabetic. Yes. You know, hey, by the way, how old is your meter? Does it talk? Does it do this? Does it do that? I can get you a free talking meter.
Yep.
Would you consent to getting a free meter? Yes. There's the opt-in. Before you know it, now you're off to the races. This is no different than any of the other pieces of the puzzle that are out there in the sales and marketing, whether it's online, whether it's telephone, whether it's whatever, not even including the theft of identities and then the, from breaches, and then, you know, and then the deep web, right, which adds to it.
And then what goes on after that is they sell it, or somehow it, it is shared. And, you know, we went out as an SIU, as part of the, you know, the UPIC. We went to these members' houses as part of Operation Brace Yourself. We'd walk in and the wall would be just boxes of braces, you know, from wrist to ankle to back to neck, the mummy kits, and not just from one company. They were from multiple companies because their identity was being sold, or these companies were related, and they were receiving equipment box after box after box. They would call the company, come pick it up. No, it's yours. You keep it. And they never even took it, took the stuff out of the box.
Right. Well, because you've got, they're waiving co-pays, so yeah, the patient is not being constantly hounded. That's number one. And, you know, at the end of the day, the biggest, the bigger problem that I see is when I see an instance where a member of a plan gets bilateral knee braces and they have a history of an above the knee amputation.
Yep.
How is that claim being paid? You're, or, you know, how many times have you seen instances with double amputees above the knee? They've had surgery. There's a medical history of that. There's a CPT code. There's an ICD-10 amputee above the knee. How is it that someone is getting two knee braces? How is it within the 5-year period or whatever the time frame is for a replacement, a claim is being paid for an additional knee brace? You know, I've seen that as well, Matt. You know, you go to the person's house, you talk to them, and they have a wall of 15 knee braces and ankle braces and you know.
And you say they don't get hounded, but they do. Well, I was in these beneficiaries' houses. How many phone calls do you get a day? Probably about 10 from the companies asking for more information. And certainly while I'm sitting there, the phone rings, they hand it to me. It was a company asking about genetic testing. We can send you the swabs. Do you want them? Do you have a history of cancer in your family? You know, it's just constant.
Right. And well, and in the genetic, and I know we're getting off a little bit, but, you know, in the genetic testing, the problem with some of that testing is it is a one and done. And there's a, you know, and there's an edit in place where after you get certain genetic related tests, you can't get it again. And the problem in that space is if I've been on a statin for cholesterol for 20 years, I don't need that genetic test for my provider to know whether or not I'm going to be able to adequately deal with that medication, right? How my body is going to deal with it. I've been on that medication for 20 years. I think I'm probably pretty good. The problem is that if I ever actually needed that test, it's a problem. This is no different, right? In the DME space, if there is actually an edit in place or something happens where the patient gets denied something that they actually need, they've run into a problem. We've seen that with, back in the day, we'd see it often with physical therapy. In physical therapy fraud, when there is the cap, it would be a $700 or $800 cap on physical therapy for the year. And if there was bogus submission of claims, it was impossible for the beneficiary to get that reversed and to get, you know, their account released, so to speak.
It creates a whole collateral. Power wheelchairs, the same thing.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah,
and there are solutions that plans can take in terms of, okay, how many DME companies do you need to have in Miami? When a new one opens up, can you put them on prepay for the first 6 months? Because a lot of these are just hit it hard early and then get out.
Right. Low-hanging fruit. And you guys will remember, you know, for those of you that don't know, in the DME space, CMS requires a surety bond because there's fraud in DME. That surety bond, I think, is $50,000. It used to be something like $5,000. It went up to $50,000. But when you see an instance where this is a $1 billion fraud, this is the price of doing business. A $50,000 bond means nothing to someone who's going to bill out $1 billion and get paid a few hundred million, right? They're not getting $1 billion. It's $1 billion in billed amounts. couple hundred million in paid amounts. But, you know, that obviously, the thing that was one of the things that was created to be a deterrent factor isn't a deterrent factor. It's the price of doing business. You know, so yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know that, you know, with us on our end, when we're doing our SIU cases and we're running our analytics are amazing. I mean, it's sometimes like I look at some of the dashboards that we're producing. They're really great. But understand that we're running our analytics on claims after the fact, right? So we're looking at our stuff from a pay and chase perspective. We are working with plans to try to do, instead of prepay, we're calling it stop and verify, which is what you're talking about, Matt. 6 months of prepay, stop and verify the claim before it goes out. But, you know, at the end of the day, from the SIU perspective, this is where SIU and payment integrity need to talk to each other about, hey, we're seeing this in the data. Why are you paying these claims out? You know, I've seen some instances in the Medicaid space where there's some carve outs where providers that aren't enrolled in Medicaid are submitting claims to Medicaid. And it's like, how is that? In the Medicare space, you can't do that. You're either participating, non-participating, or opt out. If you're non-participating, you can bill, and you're billing it out at 115% of the Medicare fee schedule. But there's an impetus for that. And in order to even bill as a non-participating, you still need to be known to the program and enrolled in some instance to understand it. So, you know, we're going back to the payers that we do our work for and saying to them, what's the deal here, folks? Like, why is this happening? And dealing with it. You know, our analytics are after the fact. We're not stopping claims. We're looking at things in that historical context. So, you know, for those of you on the payer side in the SIU space, this is a great example of where the SIU and the overall payment integrity team and your analytics team need to be chit-chatting about what the findings are. Because if you're finding these things, these are loopholes. This gets back to, and I know, Wade, we've talked about this a bunch of times, the OIG equivalent of the Management Implication Report, or the MIR. It's, hey, we've identified a program weakness, and this is what we think the problem is, and this is how we think it should be fixed. This is where you have to have those conversations and come to some conclusion about why did this happen? What's the root cause analysis of this? Because all you're doing at that point is spending money for a problem that you can fix.
Then on the MERS too, they have to be, we've talked about this too, that I just saw a report come out in a week or so ago, what the total for the unimplemented MERS was this last year. And it's in the hundreds of million dollars. It's like agents work these cases. They identify a systematic error. They research it. They report it. And I get it's resources. Maybe CMS doesn't have the resources, but they're not implemented. And those numbers right. just pile up. It's hundreds right. of millions of dollars.
Right. Well, you look at the outside of the MERS, the Management Implication Report, you look at the more global OIGs listing every year of the top 10 unimplemented recommendations, you know, where you see that over the years, we're talking about numbers in the billions of dollars, not even in the tens or hundreds of millions. The tens or hundreds of millions is potentially 1 year, but you look at that over the aggregate over years, and you're seeing that unimplemented recommendations account for potentially billions of dollars. I thought I read something, and I'm probably getting this entirely wrong, but I thought I read something that said if you looked at the cumulative IG reports for X number of years, it was something like $98 billion in savings was the number. I don't remember if I'm 100%. I don't remember my source for that, but I remember something early on in the calendar year where there was talk about that if IG's unimplemented recommendations were implemented, you'd be seeing hundreds of billions of dollars or close to it, $98 billion in savings that would come about from that. So it is something. In the SIU space, we can still do that. We find a weakness. We could still report that back to the payment integrity. I actually have a meeting next week on this exact issue. We have found some issues on one of our clients And we're having a meeting with the leadership of that plan to talk about how they can implement some recommendations for things that we have found. So you can do it. It doesn't mean that just because you're a Medicaid plan or a commercial plan or a Medicare Advantage plan that you can't implement some policies, as long as they are within the regulatory framework or the legal framework or the contractual framework, you can implement these policies. There's almost no reason why $1 billion should go out in fraud, with even with kickbacks, with patients, providers, and suppliers being geographically not centric to each other. And even within geographic centricity, we should be able to find some algorithm to be able to flag these claims, particularly if someone is getting a knee brace and their diagnosis is osteoarthritis and they've never had that as a diagnosis, they've never taken a medication for it, they've never had an issue with it, they've never had an MRI, an x-ray, they've never seen a doctor for it, and then all of a sudden they get a knee brace with a diagnosis of osteoarthritis as the reason. Well, how does that miraculously occur, right? It's just one of those things that should be a flag. So it's going to be interesting. Wade, I think you brought up a good point. What's going to happen with all of the other people? So, you know, we'll see. What was interesting to me was that you have the guy at the top of the food chain getting convicted after trial, and no press releases or nothing in the press release about prior to trial, the following 10 people have pleaded guilty and cooperated. You know, usually you see something that gives you an indicator of cooperators. There likely were cooperators, right? It's too big of a case, kickbacks. There's going to be someone, in the background. So interesting to see what happens. I'm looking forward to having some more conversations on some of the cases that are out there. We've been seeing, I'm seeing almost daily press releases with 50, 60, $70 million in billed amounts, 20, 30 million in paid amounts. So I think, you know, analyzing some of these over the next couple of weeks can be a lot of fun. So we'll see, because these things, we're seeing them here. It's not like these cases are one-offs, right? We're seeing these. We just may not be seeing them in the $100 million range because of plan sizes and things of that sort. But I'm sure people watching this are seeing similar things in their plans. So keep your eyes open. We'll keep talking about these. These are interesting things to break down, even though we only see the press release. Who knows? We'll see what happens over the next few weeks. So, as always, good times. Good seeing both of you. Good to see Matt wearing his official. Yeah, I know. Wade didn't get the memo. It's okay.
No.
We had a week off last week because of everybody being on vacation and traveling. Matt, I'm hoping that you're going to write a blog about the great time you had on your cruise.
I already did. Jean Marie's got it. So.
All right. So we'll see that. It'll be in the newsletter. We'll see that. Everybody, once you get done watching the podcast, take a look at the newsletter. Matt had a amazing time on his first big cruise. I think he's going to be one of those people who's going to be a routine cruiser as a result of this.
We're following Eisengrind's footsteps.
Yeah,
The name of the blog is Cruising on the USS Upsell.
There you go. Upselling, upcoding, it's all the same. So as always, we thank everybody for joining us. We look forward to seeing you on future broadcasts joining us. We've got some great LinkedIn Live scheduled. Again, you can get the newsletter every Friday to your inbox, advise, advizehealth.com, and reach out to us, and we'll get you that newsletter right to your inbox. And until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Have a good one, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you all.